Sheriff contains graphic descriptions of violence, and in one episode, sexual assault. It may not be suitable for all listeners. I'm Tony Adami, and you're listening to The Sheriff, a new podcast series brought to you by the Northwest Florida Daily News and the Gannett Company. Episode 1, The Wheels of Justice.
The wheels of justice in Okaloosa County have a tendency to turn very slowly.
And then what happened was we had a lot of neighbors, people, residents, old-timers come out. They would start mingling around. And, of course, there was guns and fishing poles and clothing and everything strewn all over the plaza. And there were people starting to root around there, you know. So I went ahead.
That's George Velarde. He was an Okaloosa County Sheriff's deputy back in the 1960s. That day we were talking about a tornado that hit Fort Walton Beach in 1967. Now afterward, looters began to fill up the town square. That's also George's phone that goes off there right at the end with the old Monday Night Football theme.
What happened was that night there was a big Billy Bowlegs like a Christmas party.
Now start over for me, George. Right. I'll get you on video. Go ahead.
All right. This was the night of the 10th, or actually the 9th of December, and it was a black tie affair at the Shalimar Club up in Shalimar. And the sheriff was attending, his wife, and they had a big band there. And I think it was something to do with the Billy Bowlegs Christmas, but I might be wrong.
The other voice, the guy asking for the video, that's my coworker, Nick Tomachek. He's a digital editor at the Northwest Florida Daily News, where we both work. It's also in Fort Walton Beach. We met George and his wife, Judy, back in September. They were visiting friends here in Fort Walton Beach from South Florida, and they dropped off some pictures from that tornado. George was driving around the next morning with his friend, Martin Canova, who was taking the pictures. Martin was an investigator for the Sheriff's Department at the time. I think Nick and I both liked the Velardes right away. Judy is sweet and funny and has a great memory. George loves to tell stories, from his time as a sheriff's deputy and also from his time as an agent for the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. George had a really famous case in the 1990s, even ended up on the cover of Vibe magazine. It's after he busted a group of transvestite thieves in South Florida called the Drag Queen Mafia. I believe it's the October 1993 issue with Wesley Snipes on the cover. George and Judy are really important parts of our story, but they're not going to be in it for much longer. So I want to let him finish telling you about that tornado.
A second tornado came, a small one, lifted my car. I had a 65 Ford Cruiser, picked me up, and put me directly between two telephone poles. And I'm like there putting my foot on the brake and hanging on to the steering wheel like that's going to help me, right?
You were airborne.
I was airborne.
Like Wizard of Oz.
The car went up at least two feet off the ground and then just went straight over and then slammed me back down in between these poles.
George and Judy and I talked for a long time that day. Talked about the tornado and some other old cases that George worked. You may have heard him mention a sheriff at one point there. The sheriff he was talking about was the one he worked for, Ray Wilson. Ray still holds a couple of pretty unique distinctions among sheriffs in the state of Florida. The first, he's the longest tenured sheriff in the history of Okaloosa County. Served from 1955 until 1976. Second, when he was elected, he was the youngest sheriff ever in the history of the state of Florida. He's only 27 years old. I'd heard a few stories about Ray in the past, but nothing really concrete. I knew about some cases he'd worked because they were really famous, but I think the question I asked George that day was what he was like or what it was like to work for him. And George said he really enjoyed it. He did mention that Ray got him caught up in a federal court case once when he had him bust a shipment of porno magazines headed to Okaloosa County, but they beat the case. Judy pointed out that Ray was kind of a larger-than-life figure, and she kind of explained it too. He was tall, about 6'3" or 6'4". He was thick, but not fat. He was about 220 pounds, and he always had a big cowboy hat on, either white or black, like he was an extra in a John Wayne movie or something. Then the Velardes told me a story about Ray that I'd never heard before. That day, I got the bare bones of what I'm going to try and tell you over the next few hours. It's mainly about Ray and his father, Lester Wilson. And back in the late 1950s, for reasons I'll explain soon, it was a pretty big deal at the time. In fact, the story was so well known that a really popular TV show at the time called the Armstrong Circle Theater made an episode about what happened with Ray and his dad. The Armstrong Circle Theater was kind of like an anthology show, is what we would call it now, like Black Mirror on Netflix, or The Twilight Zone, but instead of made-up stuff, they did the episodes on things that really happened.
Armstrong Circle Theater.
The Armstrong Circle Theater was pretty highly watched back in the day. It was on NBC from 1950 to 1957, then switched over to CBS until it went off the air in 1963. A lot of famous actors and actresses from the time got their start there. James Dean, Patty Duke, Robert Duvall, Jack Lemmon, Grace Kelly, Paul Newman, Gina Rowlands, Jason Robards, just naming a few of the people. The episode about what happened to Ray and his father, Lester, was called Memory of a Murder. It aired on December 7, 1960. I'm going to read you the description of the episode from that week's TV guide. The fact-based story of a new sheriff's battle to restore justice in a lawless Florida town. It's not bad, but it's pretty vague. The IMDb page for the episode actually does a much better job. Based upon the 1940 murder in Crestview, Florida, a former City of Crestview Police Chief Lester Wilson that was solved by his son, Okaloosa County Sheriff Ray Wilson, in 1958. That's actually a lot better.
These men that paid to have Granddaddy kill asked my daddy to pray for them. Okay? You hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
And so, and Dad, he found a certain degree of peace in doing that with them. I'm not saying that everybody that put money in the hat was ever, you know, did that.
And that's Stuart Wilson. He's Ray Wilson's son and Lester Wilson's grandson. To make it clear, the story he's telling there is that Ray, when he was older, was approached by men in the community about their role in his father's murder. It wasn't the men that got convicted of the killing, either. I've met with Stuart a lot over the last 6 months, and I want to say that he talks about a lot of stuff that I can't really relate to. He talks in a lot of biblical terms. He talks about the wheels of justice. He talks about blood in the ground. He talks about Cain and Abel and stuff like that. And while we don't always connect there, we do connect on some other levels. And he's been incredibly helpful to me throughout this whole process, mainly with how open he's been with his family's old history. Some of it's not great. He's not shying away from it either. It's really easy to see when Stuart talks about his father how much he loved him. And not just that, he idolized him. He slips into a kind of way of speaking sometimes about Ray that sounds like you or I might describe our favorite actor or athlete. Kind of like somebody he didn't really know all that well. Which makes sense when you hear about their relationship. They weren't really that close growing up. He said that Ray never really told him he loved him or complimented him or said he did a good job in school or sports or anything until he was much, much older. And not to say Ray was a bad father, actually. He was a really good dad. He just wasn't very affectionate, which isn't too different from people growing up at that time. But whenever Stuart does talk about his father maybe being emotionally distant, he always qualifies it. He says to point out something else if you're going to say that his dad wasn't that close with him. He said Ray didn't get a chance to grow up with the dad himself. The reason why was because his father was murdered when he was just 12 years old. And with Lester's murder is where my story that I'm trying to tell you is probably going to diverge with a lot of what's been told in the past. The old accounts you can find in newspapers and even in the trial transcripts somewhat aren't going to tell you some of the things I'm going to tell you. And I should warn viewers again that some of this is going to be pretty graphic as far as descriptions of violence. Some people might think it's kind of a small thing, and maybe it is, but I think it kind of speaks to how the case was handled by the cops and the newspapers back then. They left out a lot of important stuff. In almost every public account of the death, the murder, it's been either written or said that Lester Wilson died instantly when he was murdered in his living room on the night of March 15, 1940 in Crestview. This couldn't be further from the truth. Listening to the radio that night, sitting directly in front of the front door of his house, just feet away from his wife, Bama, who was warming herself by the fire. Lester saw a man walk up the front steps to the porch, to the front door. He's carrying a double-barrel shotgun. Lester stood up and faced the man. The man drew down on Lester and shot him through a panel of glass in the front door. The impact of the blast hit Lester right above his left eye and went up, essentially blowing off the top left side of his head with such force that skull and brain matter were embedded in the ceiling. Bama stood up when she heard the blast, saw Lester fall to the ground, and ran to the porch to see who shot him. When she turned and saw what was left of her husband's head, she began to scream. Of the Wilsons' six children, only the two youngest were home that night, 16-year-old Velma and 12-year-old Ray. They had rooms adjacent to the living room and rushed in at the exact same moment their mother would have turned back around and seen Lester. Velma began to scream as well. Ray went directly to his father, who looked at him, blinking his right eye, appearing to attempt to speak. Ray got down on his hands and knees and tried to put what was left of his father's brains back in his skull. By all accounts, from Ray and those who came upon the scene right afterward, Lester lived for at least 10 to 15 minutes after he was shot. It's hard to imagine much worse ways to die. It's hard to imagine what Ray experienced later that night as well. Here's Stuart telling me what Ray told him about that night.
I ran in there. I heard the shotgun blast. I saw part of my dad, your granddad's head, falling off. He looked at me with an eye like he was trying to say something. That's what he said, and he couldn't, and he fell over and dead. And grandmother started screaming. The other boys started screaming, and the sister. And Dad ran back into his room, and because you just witnessed something that you never thought you'd see in your life as a young child, he began to tremble. He was crying. He heard grandmother screaming. And he didn't tell me this till Dad died about 5 years ago. He didn't tell me this till 6 years ago. And he said, son, I never would tell anybody because I carried this myself all these years, but I'm letting you know what happened. He said, I sat on the edge of that bed, and as I was picking pieces of my dad and your granddad's skull, bones, fragments, and blood and tissue, brain matter, I stepped in it. And as I was trembling and cleaning my feet, two policemen outside my window said, each one to another, you know they'll never catch the killer or killers. He said, yes, I know it. My dad told me that at that young age, it burnt something and ingrained into him that there was corruption.
The night of March 15, 1940 ended with Lester Wilson's murder, but it was only the start of a vast and insidious conspiracy that would only begin to come into focus 15 years later when Ray became the youngest sheriff in the history of the state of Florida. In that time, he would untangle a web of murder, sex, drugs, small-town politics, and corruption unlike any the state had ever seen. It would also bring him face-to-face with the men who murdered his father. I'm Tony Adami, and you're listening to The Sheriff, a new podcast series brought to you by the Northwest Florida Daily News and the Gannett Company. So to tell you this story, I need to do a little bit of setup about where it's going to take place at. I'll try to make it pretty quick because I don't want us to get too far off track of where we're at right now. Almost all the story takes place in Okaloosa County, Florida, which is probably one of the prettiest places on earth because the southern part of the county is mostly made up of two cities, Fort Walton Beach and Destin, that are right on the Gulf of Mexico. They have some of the best beaches in the world. Soft, white, sugar sand beaches that give way to crystal green waters. It's called the Emerald Coast for a reason. What you don't see, and what most people that visit here don't get to experience, is a part of the county where our story takes place at, and where most of the power, money, and influence is located in this part of the state. It's a city located in the north part called Crestview, where you're pretty familiar with already. And Crestview, it's a county seat. It means the sheriff's office is there, it means the county courthouse is there, as well as the county jail. It's also known as being kind of an anomaly compared to the rest of the region of Florida, because it gets much colder in Crestview than anywhere else in the region in the wintertime, by 20 or 30 degrees usually. Lester Wilson brought his family here from Holmes County. It's a small county northeast of Okaloosa County. There's not much going on there. They came here right after World War I, which was not long after the county was founded in 1915. They actually got here by horse and buggy, if you can imagine that. Lester was a smart, hardworking, God-fearing guy who had already experienced quite a bit of tragedy in his life by the time he brought his family to Okaloosa County. One of his older brothers, Oscar, was killed in World War I. Another brother was killed in a hunting accident. He came to Laurel Hill with his wife, Bama, his son, J.D., both sets of their parents, Lester's younger brother Fox, and their younger sister Sharon Hutto, and her husband Alfred Hutto. Bama, who died in 1974, actually wrote out an 87-page memoir of her entire life in 1949, recounting everything leading up to Lester's murder in 1940. Stewart somehow kept a copy of it and had the pages reprinted and laminated for posterity. My co-worker, Savannah Evanoff, recorded some of the passages from Bama's memoir. This is a part about when she met and fell in love with Lester.
On Sunday mornings after church, the young people would all go walking about to pass time and got to the one and only small little drugstore for soda water. One Sunday, my sisters and some more girls were walking about, and my future husband came along and walked home with me. Then we went to church that night. I think we fell for each other from the start. He would come on Sundays, and he would stay a while. Then he would come back later, and we would go to church across the street. That was about as much as we would be together, and just on Sunday evenings. After a five-month courtship, we got married on the night of Thursday, December 19th, 1910, and moved into a home he'd already bought.
Bama and Lester would eventually have six children: J.D., Woodrow, Alma, Clyde, Velma, the only girl, and Ray, the youngest, was born in 1927. The family settled in Laurel Hill, where Stewart lives now. It's a small town that's as far north as you can get in Okaloosa County, and that's where they really got their footing. The Wilsons opened gas stations and they opened markets. They saw the massive influx of people moving to the county, and they mapped out land they knew was for sale. So when out-of-towners got off the train in Crestview looking to buy land, they were usually pointed in the direction of Lester and Fox, who helped broker the deals and took a commission. Lester, right away, saw Laurel Hill for what it was, and kind of what it still is. It's a nice place to live without a lot of opportunity. When he moved there, the population wasn't much different than it is today, about 500 or 600 people. He did, however, see Crestview almost double its population every year. And by the late 1920s, he was ready to make the move. Here's Savannah reading from Bama's memoir again, talking about when the family went from Laurel Hill to Crestview.
On October 18th, 1926, our sixth sweet baby and our only girl, Velma, was born. We were so proud because we wanted a little girl. We bought some more land across the highway from our house and built a little grocery store and a filling station, and we made pretty good at it. But Charlie Clary wanted to buy the store, and we sold to him and built another one in Laurel Hill. On December 27th, 1927, our seventh and last sweet baby Ray was born. He was 4 months old when my mother died on May 21st, 1928, and was buried at our old home cemetery at Whitewater Church. Then in June, Lester sold our home in Campton to Charlie Clary, and we moved to Crestview and later sold the store near Laurel Hill. Lester said he thought it would be best for the children to be where they could go to good schools and maybe have a better chance to get a start in life. All these years later, after everything that happened, sometimes I wonder if it would have been better if we had just stayed away from here. Bama Wilson, June 29th, 1949.
What Bama knew in 1949 and what we know now, and that Lester may not have totally understood in 1928, was that Okaloosa County, from almost the time it was founded, was a haven for vice. And when we say vice, I want to be really specific here. This was Prohibition era. Since 1920, you weren't allowed to drink legal in the United States of America. So, in Okaloosa County, you could find liquor, you could gamble, and you could pay for sex. You could do most of it within shouting distance of Main Street in Crestview. The Wilsons were very much what we would view today, or what we would call today, conservatives. Really conservative, actually. They didn't want to deal with the kind of stuff that was going on in Crestview or the county at the time. And they weren't alone, really. There were similar thinking people in and around the houses they bought about 1 mile north of downtown. Lester and Bama bought a place on Long Drive and started to try to make inroads by creating businesses in town. They ran into a brick wall at almost every turn. They found out pretty quickly that if you wanted to set up a gas station in Crestview, you had to let someone take bets there all day. If you wanted to open a market in Crestview, you had to be willing to play ball and let somebody sell liquor out the back. And these weren't things Lester was willing to do. It caused problems for him and his family almost immediately. And, unfortunately, he started to make a lot of enemies. Enough so that he started to tell people that he thought his life was in danger.
He perceived it as an imminent threat, not only for himself, his house, his wife, his family, but his children.
Not to say that Lester was paranoid either. He had real concerns. Paranoia might be kind of an undermining way of saying it. He was really scared for his life. He also wasn't scared to do something about it. Lester was in Crestview for about a year when a set of events started to put him on the path that would lead to his eventual murder. The first of those was the unexpected death of Okaloosa County Sheriff Peter Jackson Steele in 1930. Steele was just 40 years old, and he got hit with an unexpected illness that essentially sealed his throat shut. He'd been one of the main impediments to Lester making any inroads in Crestview. It's part of an ongoing feud between the Steeles and the Wilsons that would continue for decades. Steele was a guy who would look the other way at gambling and illegal liquor and prostitution. Lester wanted him to enforce the law, and that was kind of the impasse. When Steele died in office, Florida Governor Doyle Carlton, growing more and more aware of the county's growing reputation, moved quickly to put a replacement in place that would enforce the laws. He picked Lancelot Hughes, an auto dealer and businessman from Laurel Hill who was familiar with Lester. Hughes picked Lester to be the police chief in Crestview. This, understandably, caused problems. Lester and Hughes would spend the next several years cracking down on moonshiners and doing the best they could to bring corruption in the county to a grinding halt. In fact, during Hughes' time in office, it was reported that 800 pounds of copper were sold in Crestview, a direct result of busting illegal liquor stills. By 1932, there were already rumblings that Prohibition was coming to an end, and it would in 1933, with the passing of the 21st Amendment. It also meant the sheriff's election in 1932 would be one of the most important and hotly contested in the county's history. Both Lester and Lancelot Hughes ran for sheriff that year, and part of a crowd of fielded candidates. Lester didn't garner much of the vote, but in the end, it was a familiar name that came out on top, and someone who already very much hated Lester and everything he stood for. His name was Johnny P. Steele, the first cousin of former Sheriff Peter Jackson Steele.
It was my grandmother related more to all, and my dad too, that apparently there was a lot of corruption.
Yeah.
And he knew it, and the good people of Okaloosa County knew it, and he wanted to try to do something about it.
That was Stewart again, giving us a little bit of insight into why Lester ran for office. He really wanted to do things the right way. He wanted people to be able to live and, you know, exist without being, you know, under the thumb of people that were doing illegal things, which I think we can all kind of understand a little bit. Steele's election to sheriff in 1932 kicked off what would be an incredibly difficult time for Lester and his family. The center of the power in the county was swinging back toward the other side, away from Lester, and he was going to be directly in the crosshairs of the people who were now in charge. Now sheriff, Steele would begin to assemble a ragtag group around him, including a former bootlegger, James Alty MacArthur Sr., as his top sheriff's deputy. MacArthur had bootlegging charges dating back to 1903 in Crestview and would eventually die in the line of duty, suffering a massive heart attack while making an arrest. Another of Steele's crew was Joe Adams, who he named Constable. Adams had multiple business interests that conflicted with Lester, including a taxi service that operated out of the same cab stand in Crestview. This group of lawmen weren't alone by any means. They'd gone through quite a few pains to make sure they'd never be outnumbered. In the wings were a group of sycophants who also had their own growing hatred for Lester, and almost all of them had been jailed by him at one point or another during his time as police chief. It was a group of men who had grown up together in Crestview, and they were led by Murray MacArthur, the youngest son of James Alty MacArthur Sr., Murray's friend, Charlie Powell, brothers Jesse and Doyle Kaysen, and J.Q. Adams, a nephew of Constable Joe Adams. Collectively, they set about trying to make Lester's life a living hell. That paranoia we talked about, it was there every day. And Murray was a leader. He was a charismatic man in his mid-20s who had more friends than he could shake a stick at. He was kind of a Pied Piper of a group of losers. Wherever he went, the rest of them followed. And he not only had Sheriff Steele backing him up, but he also had his older brother, James Alty MacArthur Jr. MacArthur Jr. was a successful engineer who'd eventually build a house on Millionaire's Row in North Crestview in 1938. Murray was no slouch in his own right. He'd worked for the state roads department like his brother before, but he'd struck out on his own and was now driving his own truck and setting up routes, delivery routes, that is. So, you got Murray, you got half dozen guys behind him doing whatever he says, and then Murray's taking orders from Steele and Adams. And, on several occasions, they cornered Lester and beat him to a pulp. Right now I'm going to play a short snippet of audio. It's been reenacted from original trial transcripts I obtained. They're going to be relayed to the public for the first time in their entirety in this podcast. But the voices you're going to hear are people portraying one of the lawyers in the case, defense attorney Farron Campbell, as he cross-examines Woodrow Wilson, one of Lester Wilson's sons and Ray Wilson's little brother. In later episodes, I'm going to play a lot of reenacted parts of this trial, I don't want us to get to the trial too quickly, but I do need to play this part right now because it can put into context some of what I'm telling you about Lester and the threat he faced every day.
You testified that Johnny Steele never talked with you about the case, never interviewed you in connection with the investigation. Did you see him the night your father was shot, Woodrow?
Yes, sir.
Where did you see him?
At the front gate.
Woodrow, did you allow him into the house at that time?
He was so late getting there. I don't know what time it was, but it must have been at least 10 o'clock, and he had been. Do you want me to go ahead and tell you a little story?
Oh, yes, go ahead.
He had been protecting some guys that were jumping on my daddy. When they would jump on him, he would arrest my daddy and have him charged and go through court. But the boys that jumped on him were never arrested. One of the boys that was in the affair one time told my daddy, "Johnny Steele is protecting us, and there's nothing you can do about it." Therefore, when Johnny came up to the gate, I happened to be in the door, and I told him, "There's no use coming any further," because I knew nothing would be done about it.
Was there some hard feelings or ill will between the two of them?
Yes, sir.
Was it any of these three defendants that jumped on your daddy?
No, sir.
To your knowledge, Woodrow, did either of these three ever have any difficulty with your father or any hard feelings?
They never did jump on him.
Did you see Joe Adams any of the night your father was shot?
No, sir. If you ever...
That's okay. Keep going, Woodrow. It's okay.
No, sir. If he ever came out of the house, I don't know about it. Either I was gone, on, in the house, or I didn't see him. I don't believe he came out of the house, though.
You testified, I believe, that your father had some trouble with these other boys.
No, sir. I didn't say he had trouble.
I mean, some other boys jumped on him. Excuse me, Woodrow.
Yes, sir. Some other fellows. I didn't say these boys.
Who were the other boys?
Murray MacArthur and Chance Powell, and on one occasion, J.Q. Adams.
You said Chance Powell, but do you by chance mean Charlie Powell?
Yes, sir. Charlie Powell.
Thank you.
This actually backs up something that Stuart told me about Lester, as relayed to him by Ray over the years.
Dad told me this in the past years, right before he died. He said, "My dad, your granddad, called all of us boys in, even young boys, and said, 'They're out to kill me.'" And he named some names. I don't know the names he named. He said, "If you see this man, that man, or that man on Main Street, you boys duck into a store, go out the back door, you peek out, you see if he's gone." And he said, "They're out to murder me."
They're out to murder me. Think about that for a second and put yourself in Lester's shoes. You come to this thriving county from a rural part of the state thinking you're going to make your fortune, or maybe not even a fortune. You just want to make a life for you and your kids. Better life, so Bama said in her memoir. And because you want to follow the law, the people in charge want to kill you. The people that hold all the power want you dead. Why? Because you just don't want to follow their rules. And their rules were liquor, gambling, and prostitution. And because Lester didn't want any part of that, his life was in danger. I'm Tony Adami, and you're listening to The Sheriff, a new podcast series brought to you by the Northwest Florida Daily News and the Gannett Company. Let's recap what we know about Lester right at this time. He was in fear for his life and the lives of his children and his wife because of what had become, essentially, a blood feud since the 1932 election. And I found out something else from this time that didn't make it into the newspapers or the trial transcripts. In December of 1934, the Pensacola News Journal ran an article about Lester, about how he opened a casket-making business in Crestview. Lester did this by building a separate structure, essentially a work building, next to his house on Long Drive. 3 months later, the dead of the night, it burned to the ground. Lester lost about $2,000, equivalent to about $40,000 or $50,000 today. So you might ask at this point, why keep going on? Why continue to fight like Lester did? Why not just move somewhere else? I think a lot of it has to do with how his sons looked at it. It's kind of going back to what Bama said in her memoir, but wanting them all to have a better life.
Lester said he thought it would be best for the children to be where they could go to good schools and maybe have a better chance to get a start in life.
And you know, I think that's something we can all relate to. You want to make a better life for yourself, for your children. You want to make money. You want to live without fear of retribution for not following the status quo. And the back down for Lester just wasn't an option. But more and more, he was finding out that he wasn't alone. People in the county were getting fed up with what was going on. The repeal of Prohibition in 1933 had done little to slow down the vice in the county. Crestview, and everywhere else. And just like today, it was the lower middle-class families that seemed to suffer the most. You know, families were being torn apart by gambling and liquor. Women in the town were pressed into prostitution because they were desperate or in debt, which, if you think about it, isn't too different from the problems a lot of cities face today with human trafficking. And I think, to Lester's credit, he saw this and he hated it. He wanted to fight against it in every way he could. So knowing this, and knowing that almost everyone close to him did not want him to run for sheriff again, he did, in 1936. Against the incumbent, Johnny P. Steele, his enemy, and he ran as a huge underdog. And to no one's surprise, Lester lost, again. But to everyone's surprise, it was really, really close. He lost in a runoff vote that no one saw coming. And after the election, accusations started to fly between the two sides that included missing ballot boxes. It was something that would come up again in the next election. So, while Steele was the winner of the election, there was a lot of damage done. The old guard didn't trust him anymore. Lester's close call had fired up the people, the working class people. And pretty soon his name began being thrown around as a favorite, possibly, in the next 1940 election for sheriff. He would be the first outsider to win the office, the first person not from Crestview or Okaloosa County to hold it. And it had a double negative impact on Steele. That he'd almost lost to Lester, a scrappy teetotaler, was looked at as kind of a mark of shame in his circle. And the powers that be soon began to confer on how they could get a better, stronger candidate in place to run the next election. And they wanted to make sure Lester never ran for sheriff again. I'm Tony Adami, and you're listening to The Sheriff, a new podcast series brought to you by the Northwest Florida Daily News and the Gannett Company. The next 2 years were much of the same for Lester and his family. Enemies at every turn, always looking over your shoulder, and all while working in a variety of businesses to make sure his family was well taken care of. Those business interests began to take on a more pronounced effort. As his sons got older and they came to join him, other businesses were finding it more and more hard to keep up with them. They couldn't get around the fact that Lester's ventures could stay open longer because he now had more workers in his queue. For example, when Lester would work a daytime shift on his taxi, one of his older sons, Woodrow, could take over the night shift. The other boys, Alma and Clyde, could also do odds and ends at the gas stations or markets or help around the house. Ray was only 12 but was already showing he was ready to work and help out, riding his bicycle back and forth from downtown to deliver food or messages from Bama to the other boys. Part of having a cab business back then, and it's not really different than driving an Uber or a Lyft now, is that if you want to do that, a lot of your fares are probably going to be people that maybe have been drinking a little bit. And to put it in perspective, Crestview had a pretty thriving bar scene back in the 30s and 40s. Unbelievably, actually. They had a place called Juke Hill. And right now I'm going to play a little audio from some time I spent talking with a man named Jimmy Whitaker, who has owned radio stations in Crestview since the 1950s. And Jerry Milligan, who was the mayor of Crestview for quite some time. They knew Ray growing up. They were both a little bit younger, but they knew him when he was sheriff, and they became very close with him after he was sheriff. So I'm going to let them explain the bar scene in Crestview in the 40s a little better than me. So excuse my butchering of Juke Hill. I think I call it Drug Hill at one point.
Town? Do you remember any place like that? Like some place where people would go to drink and just do whatever?
Jimmy, there were lots of places where they would go to drink.
Yeah, yeah.
Mr. Whitaker, you remember anything like that?
Yeah, there was two or three of those places. Mar Camp was one of them.
What was it called?
Mar Camp, M-A-R-C-A-M-P, Mar Camp.
That was the name of the bar or the tavern?
Yeah. Crestview Bar.
There was Crestview Bar and...
Old Quaker.
Yeah.
Old Quaker?
Old Quaker.
And those places were around for quite a while?
Yep.
And some of them, the buildings are still here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no.
Did they keep them on the outskirts of town?
No.
Not necessarily. Some of them were pretty close to downtown.
Okay.
Yeah.
There were places down on South 85 about where Bell's, and then, which is the old Walmart shopping center. maybe a quarter, half a mile this side of Walmart, used to be known as Juke Hill.
As Drug Hill?
Juke Hill. J-U-K-E, Juke Joints.
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah. Juke Hill, yeah, Juke Joint, that's like where people are going to dance and drink.
Yeah, that's
especially drink. And,
so you might ask why I'm trying to get a guy in his 80s and a guy in his early 90s to explain what the bar scene was like back in Crestview, Florida in the late 1930s and early 1940s to me. It's because I'm trying to get a better understanding of what life was like back then for people that lived in Crestview. People that went to bars specifically. You tell me Lester is at a bar at 3 a.m., I assume it's because he has a taxi service. He had to drop people off and pick them up at odd hours. I don't really know what other people were doing there, though, in Crestview. I don't know what that social scene was like. I don't know what they dealt with. And I do know that on the morning of March 1st, 1939, about 3 a.m., those two worlds collide in a pretty awful, violent way. And it changed the path of everyone's life, and two families, forever and ever. So I don't know why Charlie Powell and Marie MacArthur were at the Spur Cafe on Juke Hill that night. But I do know what happened after Charlie and Murray and Lester all ran into each other. Tell Charlie's side of it first. Charlie and Murray's side. According to Charlie, he and Murray were at the Spur Cafe. They were getting into their truck outside of the bar when Lester began shooting at them from inside of his car. He killed Murray and he seriously wounded Charlie. According to Lester and one key eyewitness, Quentin Steele, much different scenario unfolded. Here's that side of the story. As Lester left the Spur Cafe and began to walk toward his car, he noticed Charlie and Murray coming out after him. They began shouting at Lester to stop, a scenario he'd already experienced many times in the previous years. Lester hustled to his car and quickly got in the back seat, locking himself in. The windows were only 2 to 3 inches at the top, down. He crouched down in the back seat, taking a handgun out of the brown paper bag he carried around with him constantly, and another out of his ankle holster. Here's Stewart talking about those guns.
Granddad told him. And he even carried two pistols. I believe one was modified some kind of, I don't even know, they were ankle holsters back then. And then his people always thought that he walked around with a lunch sack. He had a brown paper sack if he was on Main Street. But that was his main go-to pistol. So when he walked around with a lunch sack, it didn't have sandwiches in it, it had a pistol in it.
Charlie got to the car first and began banging on the car windows and trying to open the door on the front passenger side to get to Lester. Lester popped up out of the back seat and began shooting through the window. The first shot missed, but the second shot hit Charlie. At the same time, Murray came up on the rear driver's side door of the car, directly to Lester's left. Lester turned and fired on Murray, killing him. Murray was 27 years old. Lester was taken into custody immediately. He said it was self-defense. Right away, he told the story of a years-long feud between himself and the two men, including several incidents related to the last election and stretching back to when he was chief of police in Crestview. Murray's family held his funeral just a few days later. Among his pallbearers were the sheriff, Johnny P. Steele, and Bob Sykes, the man who owned and operated the paper of record in Okaloosa County, the Okaloosa News Journal. The Okaloosa News Journal also led coverage of Lester's case, which I can describe with total objectivity as shameful. From the beginning, it was one-sided in favor of Murray and very much slanted against Lester. One article I read talked about what a great guy Murray was and how much he was going to be missed. It was in the same news article that described Lester's arrest. On April 26th, a grand jury indicted Lester for manslaughter and set the trial for the first week of May. The trial was perhaps the most sensational in the history of the county. It was held in Crestview, where the courtroom was packed to the brim every day, featured 25 witnesses over several days. Newspaper accounts of the day noted that one man even fainted from the trial. At 9 p.m. on May 2nd, 1939, the court handed the case over to the jury to deliberate, with an order from the judge to discuss the case into the night if they had to. They delivered the verdict at 3 a.m. not guilty. Lester Wilson was a free man. And, freshly acquitted of manslaughter, he announced he would be running for sheriff in 1940. On the next episode of The Sheriff.
Tell me, what your father, you said he did talk about Murray. Tell me what he said about Murray.
Murray, that he was a marvelous young man.
Okay.
He and another man named Charlie Powell approached the car where a guy who had been kicked out as either sheriff or deputy sheriff shot them through the window. They were just kidding around. And he shot them both, but only Murray died.
You remember, does either one of you remember a family, the Kaysens?
Yep.
What can you tell me about the Kaysens?
Well, they've been around here for years.
Yeah.
The Kayson family had.
I did get the sense that the law was really after my granddad, and the sense that... Let's put it this way. My dad told me, had it not been for one eyewitness that saw them coming out, that was apparently, I don't know if it was a star eyewitness or whatever, that saw them coming out of that bar, they would have probably found him guilty.
The Sheriff was recorded at the Northwest Florida Daily News in Fort Walton Beach, Florida. It was researched and written by Tony Adami and edited by Nick Tomachek. Additional voice work was provided by Savannah Evanoff and Nathan Cobb.